desires. O patron of the righteous, O security of the fearful, O responder to the supplication of the distressed, O storehouse of the destitute, O treasure of the pitiful, O help of the help seekers, O accomplisher of the needs of the poor and the miserable, O most generous of the most generous, O most merciful of the merciful, to you is my humble subjection and request, to you my pleading and imploring. I ask you to let me attain the repose of your good pleasure, and to make constant toward me the favors of your kindness. Here I am, standing before the gate of your generosity, opening myself up to the breezes of your goodness, holding fast to your strong cord, clinging to your firm handle.
يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرح باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق بكم يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرح باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق.
So what is being said is that we overlook our own personal behaviors, our own personal manners, and we focus on those behaviors and those manners which Allah the Almighty has commanded us to do, right? So for example, whether it's speaking the truth, likewise not lying, being humble, being kind to others, helping the needy, praying our prayers, our salah, our namaz, right? So these are all the behaviors and manners that Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, the Creator, the Sustainer, has told us to undertake. Now, there are times where we might not feel like giving somebody money, or we might not feel like helping somebody for whatever, you know, petty reason. In these situations, we should overlook our behavior and completely submit to the kingdom of the existence of Allah. Do that which Allah wants us to do. And when we do this, we leave our heart and our mind and our body, we leave it with Allah, who is in reality the original owner of these. And slowly, but perhaps surely even, with time and practice and consistency and motivation and determination, an individual can reach a point where their eyes become divine and they see with the eyes of Al-Haq, meaning Allah, and their ears become divine and they hear with the ears of Al-Haq, Allah. And we see this very clearly in the divine messengers and in the divine infallible imams. These individuals who were, as said, infallible, they committed no sin, whether large or small, knowingly or unknowingly. And they reached a level where they are known as Yadhullah, the hand of Allah, or Saifullah, the sword of Allah, or Asadullah, the lion of Allah, all based upon this idea of overlooking the self in order to see the divine.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Manan,
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, Ya Rahman, haqqiq amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. Ya Allah, Ya Manan, haqqiq amanina.
Sorry, you know. أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Nami Farhat Al-Amali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A lot of youth are turning to religion, but some of them become very extreme. They start interpreting verses and narrations and coming up with their own theories that are not based on any solid evidence, but rather on the weak understanding of religion. And the moment you disagree with them, they start attacking you. This is a problem, but it is never too late to change. What you need to do before you start memorizing information is to work on your spirituality, to clean yourself through losing your ego. Reading is very important, but it's not enough. It is like you have a cup of water in front of you. You read how tasty the water is, how pure it is. Reading can give you some information about the water, but it doesn't make you taste the water. When you work on your spirituality, when you work on cleaning yourself and destroying your ego, you will get a chance to taste how pure the water is. And when this water goes down into your heart, it will remove extremism and it will fill your heart with love to everyone. It will make you accept everyone, even those who you disagree with. It will make you open up to everyone, to love good for everyone, because religion is nothing other than love. Lose your ego to win yourself. Understand that you are nothing to receive everything. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website, www.parshtoday.com.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So continuing what we were saying, of course, which was this idea of in our ubudiyya, in our servitude of Allah, and our servitude to Allah, and our obedience to Allah, that we must overlook the self if we want to see the divine. And so we just talked about in the previous segment, of course, how it's so important that we overlook our own personal, private, sometimes, and most likely biased and prejudiced manners and behaviors, overlook these, sacrifice these in order to submit ourselves entirely to the Almighty Allah and to do those behaviors and those manners which the Almighty Allah has requested and commanded us to do. Now, another one of the things which falls under this category of overlooking the self is that we have to remove ourselves from being among the veils of this world, the hijabat, the veils, the curtains, the barriers that this materialistic world creates. And so as long as we are enwrapped in the veils and the hijabat of this world, and we live within the covers of nature, within the limitations of physicalityness and materialistness, we cannot have the knowledge of the other world. And thus, we will not be able to keep warm by a remote fire. So, of course, here we have to understand that knowledge of the other world, knowledge of the actions that we do in this world, the knowledge of the relationship between this world and the next world, the knowledge of what our purpose in this life and our purpose of life really is. This knowledge is the source of life, and it is the source of eternity, and it is the source of our human perfection. But if we become enwrapped in the veils of materialism and consumerism and capitalism and even communism and these kind of different things, if we become enwrapped in the veils of the material world, wealth, money, power, glory, etc., then we will not be able to acquire that knowledge which is beneficial to us both in this world and the next. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A huge number of Ukrainian refugees continue to arrive at EU borders in Poland, Slovakia, Romania and Hungary. On Thursday, EU Home Affairs ministers adopted the Temporary Protection Directive. It means the refugees can work and go to school in any of the bloc's 27 member states for at least 1 year.
If you compare to the refugees that came in 2015, how long time it took to have the proper decisions. For example, just to have their asylum applications processed, it could take years.
So, by the EU's own admission, refugees travelling here from conflict zones involving Western military powers did not and do not receive the same protection. Meanwhile, advocates are calling on the EU to pay particular attention to certain groups.
In general, people who are displaced in a forced way are vulnerable. But we want to call attention to specifically the situation of women and girls because they are disproportionately affected.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen travelled to Slovakia and Romania on Thursday to assess the refugee crises facing the two EU nations. She took the opportunity to try and apply additional pressure on Moscow.
The three waves of sanctions we introduced are already having an impact on the Russian economy and therefore Putin's war effort. And we will take additional steps if the situation deteriorates on the ground.
Non-EU country Moldova has taken in more than 100,000 Ukrainian refugees so far. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell visited the country on Thursday to offer support. However, there is concern over the treatment of some who are trying to reach the EU from Ukraine. Senior UN officials are criticising evidence of discrimination by EU border authorities against African and Asian nationals attempting to flee the conflict. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
Al Al-Fajr cultural days have kicked off, but this time it is not held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Rather, Beirut is hosting the event like many other Iranian art exhibitions held here.
Activities include many art activities, theater, music, exhibition, seminars, and other activities.
The Iranian Minister of Culture opened the festivals with an awe-inspiring musical concert. Iranian musicians there are glad to be attending such an event.
I'm a musician from Iran. I play oud, a common instrument in Muslim world. I really like the Arabic culture, Arabic countries' cultures. By myself, and I think the collaboration between Muslim countries, it would be good. Something like Fajr days in Lebanon, and I really enjoy my stay in Lebanon.
The many facets of Iran's artistic culture have come all the way to Lebanon, from the folklore dress to post-Islamic calligraphy.
This exhibition is for Iranian exhibition for the Iranian handicraft for before Islam and after Islam.
According to organizers, this event is significant in that it represents part of collaboration between Iran and Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The World Bank has recently approved a plan to use more than $1 billion from a frozen Afghan trust fund for aid in Afghanistan through UN agencies and charities. Afghan experts welcoming the move suggest that there should be a clear mechanism for disbursing the money so that Afghanistan gains the greatest benefits.
Allocating $1 billion as aid is a piece of good news for Afghanistan, but there should be a clear and appropriate mechanism so that the money is not wasted like hundreds of billions of dollars that were poured into Afghanistan in the past 20 years. I think, first of all, the UN should come to an understanding with the Taliban. Then they can assess needs or create jobs through developmental and fundamental projects.
This comes as unemployment, poverty, and hunger crises are deepening in Afghan society. Afghans expect the Taliban and international community to create job opportunities, calling for unfreeze of Afghanistan's frozen funds and more aid to the country.
We have been experiencing a very harsh winter. Many died of hunger and illnesses. We neither have a job nor received humanitarian aid.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and large global funds to the country were halted. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turkey has closed the passage of warships through its Straits of Bosphorus and Dardanelles. The decision was taken after Ankara called Russia's military action in Ukraine a war. President Erdogan said Turkey is using the authority given to it by the 1963 Montreux Convention Pact on passage of its Straits to prevent the escalation of the Russia and Ukraine conflict.
Turkey is determined to use the authority given by the Montreux Convention on Turkish Straits in a manner to prevent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Erdogan said he was very saddened by Moscow's attack on its neighbor, describing the move as unacceptable, adding that Turkey will not abandon its ties with both Ukraine and Russia. The Turkish defense minister, in his turn, asked all sides to respect the international pact Turkey has worked by, assuring that it is Ankara's right to limit passage in the straits in wartime. Kiev had already asked Turkey to close its straits to the Russian warships. The move will prevent more Russian ships from reaching the Black Sea, from where it had launched attacks on Ukrainian southern coast. Analysts say Turkey's decision does not only help Ukraine but also Russia, as the decision prevents all warships, not only Russian ones, from crossing the straits.
Turkey is following a balanced policy between the two countries. The president already clearly stated that Ankara will not take side and stand with neither Russia nor Ukraine. However, enforcing the Montreux Convention is an international procedure, which will not affect Russia negatively, and Ukraine had already asked for it, hence Turkey will not be put in a position to choose sides. However, Turkey already rejects the Russian military action.
Turkey maintains good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, as it bought S-400 missiles from the first and sold the drones to the second, and does not seem willing to risk taking sides in this conflict. It seems that Turkey is trying to remain impartial in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, while it's trying to mediate to end the fight, with President Erdogan making some calls and pushing for a political solution. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Home Office has verified that the majority of people trying to reach the UK's shores via the English Channel are fleeing war and persecution. This comes in response to allegations made by the Home Secretary that the majority are illegitimate, in her own words, asylum shoppers.
If the laws that they're trying to put through Parliament at the present time, if they had been in process at the time that the present Home Secretary, Priti Patel, the time her family came as refugees and asylum seekers from Uganda, they would not have been allowed to come into the United Kingdom. Or if they did come into the United Kingdom, they would be put into some sort of detention camps that she is advocating.
The issue of Ukrainian refugees also got off to a rocky start, with the Home Secretary suggesting they could benefit from fruit picker visas. Now, under pressure, the government is offering emergency visas for those with family members already living in Britain. But at the same time, the government is pushing through legislation that will criminalise those coming from the Middle East and Africa, specifically via the English Channel, and people protesting this are getting mixed responses.
It's interesting that while we've been reporting here today, we have heard people pass by making some pretty off-colour remarks about refugees arriving here in this country. And that just confirms that there is a lack of sympathy here. And some would say those sentiments stem from misinformation, but most importantly, from racism. White skin, blue eyes. They've said it on the media. White skin, blue eyes means you're acceptable. If you're brown-skinned or black-skinned, you're not acceptable. And it's a form of apartheid.
There are people who have been driven to suicide after arriving in Britain. There were actually more people dying after being in the hands of the Home Office here than the numbers that had been dying crossing the Channel. And that is crazy to think that the hope and the aspiration that drives a person to risk their life, the kind of Britain that they're hoping for, is the one we want to live in. But it's not the one we have. It's what we have is deeply driven, divided by racism.
The Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK extraordinary powers to criminalise, prosecute and imprison refugees, and give the Coast Guard immunity from prosecution if refugees die at sea. There have been widespread protests demanding this bill be scrapped, specifically now that the government is poised to issue hundreds of thousands of visas for Ukrainians, proving that when there's a will, there's a way. Bianca Rahimi, London.
British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's licence to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik, as well as their subsidiaries, will no longer be able to spread their lies to justify Putin's war and to sow division in our union.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy. And that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time, but observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes.
The prisoners are our red line. We will not allow prison authorities to cross it, and we will not remain silent on these punitive measures against our freedom fighters. And we know at the end of the day they will achieve victory as they did in previous battles. The prison administration knows very well what it's doing will only lead to more tension.
As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under the so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Following the recent retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army and its aerial strikes on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, the United Nations Security Council imposed an arms embargo on Yemen's Ansarullah movement. This measure was proposed by the UAE in an attempt to curtail the military capabilities of the Yemeni army.
Arms embargo on Yemen is not new. As everyone knows, we are prohibited from even buying fuel, foodstuffs. Today, Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel crisis due to the seizure of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni army depends on the Yemeni military industries, which have proven to the world the growing military capabilities of Yemen. This resolution will not stop the Yemeni missile attacks, but rather will prompt the Yemeni army to intensify its retaliatory operations.
In a Twitter post, the member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, criticized the measure, saying it has ignored war crimes by the Saudi-led coalition. He noted that any arms embargo that does not apply to the Western-backed coalition has no value.
The Security Council's resolution will not affect Yemen in facing the Saudi-led war. The Yemeni army continues to make progress on all battlefronts, and this measure is only aimed at satisfying Saudi Arabia and its allies. The resolution also aims to prolong the war on Yemen and halt any move toward peace. We, as the Yemeni people, are besieged. Our airports and ports are closed, and we cannot buy weapons like other countries. So this decision will not have any effect.
Saudi Arabia's allies have launched a deadly war on Yemen since the beginning of 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to escalate its retaliatory attacks against Saudi and Emirati territories.
Experts say the Yemeni army depends on local military industries in addition to the spoils of war left by the Saudi-led coalition's forces after escaping the battlefronts. They believe that the UN resolution will make no difference as Yemen is besieged by Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the war. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy. And that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us we need to relook at his life in the manner with looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, and the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism, because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions. At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saeed Purazup, London.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Much of the Western mainstream media coverage of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine has displayed once again the blatant white supremacism that is still present in the Euro-American outlook onto the rest of the world. The article you're about to hear has been written by Denijal Djajic, a writer and researcher currently based in Beirut, Lebanon. He holds a PhD in American Studies. The article is titled Blatant Orientalism in Western Media Coverage of Ukraine War, and the article has been taken from Press TV's website. Much of the Western mainstream media's coverage of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine has displayed once again the blatant white supremacism that is still present in the Euro-American outlook onto the rest of the world. As many Ukrainians are forced to flee their homes as a result of the Russian intervention in Ukraine, the political and media discourse around refugees has at times been inherently racist. Numerous white Western journalists and media personalities could not hold back their outburst of Orientalism and white supremacy when reporting on the situation in Ukraine. The idea that a war could happen in civilized Europe surprised many pundits. Of course, Europe, which has caused both world wars, has waged its many colonial and imperialist wars mostly in the Third World. Besides the fact that war in Ukraine has been ongoing since 2014, and that an actual genocide took place in the 1990s in the cruel wars in Yugoslavia, the underlying assumption now was that because of Europe's alleged supremacy, the idea of war was only imaginable elsewhere, in the uncivilized parts of the world. In fact, some of the current media coverage reproduces the Orientalist contrast between the civilized white Christian West and the uncivilized rest of the world. The British newspaper The Daily Telegraph published an article by Daniel Hanan in which the author referred to Russia's actions as an attack on civilization itself. They, the author argued, referring to Ukrainians, seem so like us, that is what makes it so shocking. Stating that Ukraine is a European country, the author opposes its people who watch Netflix and have Instagram accounts to impoverished and remote populations. Reporting from Kiev, CBS News correspondent Charlie Degatta claims Ukraine is not a place with all due respect like Iraq or Afghanistan, but rather relatively civilized, relatively European. Speaking to the BBC, Ukraine's former Deputy General Prosecutor David Sakvaridze said, "It's very emotional for me because I see European people with blonde hair and blue eyes being killed every day with Putin's missiles and his helicopters and his rockets." His remarks remained unchallenged by the broadcaster, the BBC. These are but examples of the double standard and racist creation of difference. The rhetoric is based on the assumption that war is a natural circumstance outside of the allegedly superior European-American sphere, and that non-white people, that is the vast majority of the world's population, engage in wars because they are not civilized, not because of colonial and imperialist wars. This perspective also reveals how comfortably unaffected these media personalities must have been by all the wars launched against people in the Third World. White supremacy is the fundamental of European-American civilization. The Orientalist division of human beings into desirable and undesirable people has been structurally inscribed in dominant media discourse. The discourse around civilization not only reinforces Europe's violent racial hierarchies, but also explicitly normalizes warfare against people who do not look like the white, blue-eyed, blonde-haired European. The double standard has also been apparent in the compassionate support that some mainstream media outlets have extended to Ukrainians who took arms to fight against Russian troops. Sky News showed live on air how Ukrainians were manufacturing Molotov cocktails. The New York Post celebrated a Ukrainian soldier who blew himself up to prevent a Russian advance as heroic. Some Ukrainians have posted pictures online of themselves carrying weapons, like members of parliament Kyra Rudik. Their actions were widely praised. White victims are given moral and ideological support. Their militancy is glorified. Muslims and people of color who have organized in armed resistance are unlikely to be met with such praise. In fact, victims of U.S. imperialism and violence are themselves blamed, and their words and actions are policed. Palestinians who choose to resist the brutal decades-long Israeli occupation of their land are regularly condemned as militants and terrorists in the mainstream Western media. In fact, Palestinians do not even have to resist, as they're often by default depicted as a threat to Western civilization. Genocidal violence against them is presented as Israeli defense. The Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, is not shown as patriotic heroes, but regularly demonized as an armed terrorist organization by the same media outlets that glorify white people taking up arms. The visible hypocrisy shows the staunch perseverance of white supremacism in mainstream Western media discourse. While the media creates powerful images and narratives, it also reflects societal dynamics. The double standard in reacting to war has been manifest in the continuous discrepancy between the rhetoric on freedom and democracy and a selective outrage. While the media creates powerful images and narratives, it also reflects societal dynamics. The double standard in reacting to war has been manifest in the continuous discrepancy between the rhetoric on freedom and democracy and the selective outrage. As Central and Eastern European governments have opened their borders for Ukrainian refugees, the racialization of people fleeing their homes continues. Poland allows white Ukrainians to cross the border, but there have been numerous reports of black people being denied entry to Poland, many of which remain stuck at the Ukrainian side of the border. This adds to the continuous mistreatment of refugees at the European Union and NATO's eastern frontier. The Bulgarian Prime Minister said that Ukrainian refugees were Europeans, educated and intelligent people, unlike previous refugees who might have been terrorists. The climate for the current discourse has been present for years. Long before Russia's intervention in Ukraine, anti-Russian fear-mongering has been part and parcel of Western narratives of the common enemy. The outspoken condemnation against Russia has swiftly entailed new sanctions and boycotts, with Russian media being banned and Russians being excluded from participating in sporting events. Meanwhile, calls for the boycott of the Israeli regime by Palestinians and human rights supporters around the world have vehemently been condemned by the European Union elites for years and oftentimes smeared as being anti-Semitic. The current dynamics reveal the unfortunate continuation of Orientalist and white supremacist structures.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. This is The Lantern, and thank you very much for joining us on this brand new episode of the show, coming to you not live from the studios of IRRB English Radio. As human beings, or as creatures who a great aspect of their existence is material and pertains to a world that can only be perceived through the physical senses, we are very much obsessed with our appearance. And to an extent, it's totally okay. I mean, we have numerous ahadith which relate that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the rest of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam would, you know, they would take care of themselves, they'd have skincare routine, hair routine. They would wear perfume, they would check themselves out in the mirror, groom themselves, you know, they were always well-kempt and well-groomed and, you know, tried to look their best in public, at home, for their loved ones, for their wives, for their family members. And that's totally fine. Islam is totally against scruffiness, untidiness, unstylishness, and it encourages us to take good care of our appearance, and it acknowledges that aspect as a part of our identity and how we are recognized in society. However, everything is best in moderation. Because we are material beings, it's really easy for us sometimes to get too obsessed with the apparent physical material aspect of our existence, which if we really ponder upon is actually the smaller portion of who we are. And as much as Islam encourages us to take care of our appearance and take care of our bodies and take care of our physique and this and that, it very much opposes the notion, the idea, the culture of measuring someone's worth and determining their value based on those material aspects. Let's listen to a short story. And I love the story, especially because it involves puppies. But let's listen to it, and maybe we'll get a better idea of what we're trying to discuss here. And we'll be right back.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, dear friend, salam. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. Today we have a new story. Let's see what's our story for today. Puppies for sale. A sign above a shop read, "Puppies for sale." Signs like these have a way of grabbing the attention of the children. A small boy, upon seeing the sign, entered into the shop asking, "How much are you selling the puppies for?" The store owner said, "Anywhere from $30 to $50. The little boy removed all the money he had from his pocket. "See, I have $2.37, he said. "Can I please look at them?" The shop owner smiled and whistled. From the kennel, 5 cute puppies ran out. One puppy was lagging considerably behind. Pointing at the dog, the little boy asked, "What is wrong with that one?" The shopkeeper explained, "The hip socket of the puppy is missing. At least, that is what the veterinarian said. It will never walk properly again." The little boy cheered with excitement. "That is the puppy that I want to buy." "You don't have to buy that dog. You can have it for free." The little boy was upset. He looked up at the shop owner and said, "I don't want you to give him to me. That dog is of equal worth as the rest of the dogs. I'll give you $2.37 now and 50 cents a month until I have him fully paid for." The shopkeeper replied, "Are you sure you want this dog? It is never going to walk, run, or play with you." The little boy lifted one side of his pants up, exposing his crippled legs supported on a big metal brace. He looked up at the shop owner and softly replied, "Well, I don't run so well myself, and the little puppy will need someone who understands. There is no greater disability in society than the inability to see a person as more." There was an interesting quote by Robert M. Hensel, and that is a good ending for today's episode. I invite you to listen to the continuation of this program, Lantern, from IRIB English Radio.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
All right, so maybe this was a too philosophical of a spin on or an interpretation of a very lighthearted, simple, Hallmark chicken soup for the soul sort of story. But it's good to have an analytic, critical view of everything that comes our way, because it helps us find deeper meaning to every situation. Children do this a lot, by the way. Children, because they're still so innocent, and that fitrah that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has entrusted us with is still so pristine and pure and clean. It's untainted, it's unpolluted, uncorrupted, undistorted still. They can very much more easily tap into that moral. They can more easily see the world through, I don't want to say rose-colored glasses, but that sibgha, if we pretend for a moment for the sake of the expression, that Allah's sibgha, the color which Allah paints the world with, is rosy, then yes, their world is a bit more rosy, and it's a nicer, merrier place to reside in. And often we see how children can very much more easily make friends with others, regardless of how they look, how tall, how short, to a certain age. And then they are corrupted enough by society and the negative, toxic mindset of their parents, of their environment, of the media. And then they slowly begin to judge, they slowly begin to bully, they slowly begin to express really mean, really cruel comments about people's appearances or the way some person speaks, or the way some person walks, or their eyes, or this or that. But in the case of children, they don't see color, they don't see disabilities, they don't see differences. They just think to themselves, well, he or she's my friend. Or they just want to relate to something, and they see themselves in the other thing, and it makes it precious for them. It makes it worthy, it makes it cherishable. Now imagine if we could maintain that way of thinking that we all had when we were kids. I mean, after all, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said that children are not born Christian, Jewish, or anything. They're born pure and clean, and then they're taught certain doctrines and ideologies and dogmas. Some are toxic, some are, you know, pretty wholesome. And then they develop a worldview, and then their personality and their approach toward others is based on that. So imagine if we could maintain that innocence and expand our minds to be able to, okay, maybe not see myself in another, but see God. How about that? Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.